the world, however crafty, would think of opening. A safe vault operated by the biggest patsy in the world. The bun compartment in that oddball vendor's wagon. Chapter 11.
Aw, look,
Santa said, holding the newspaper close to her eyes.
They got a cute picture show on in the neighborhood with little Debbie Reynolds. Aw, she's sweet,
Mrs. Riley said.
You like her, Claude?
Who's that?
Mr. Robichaux asked pleasantly.
Little Deborah Reynolds,
Mrs. Riley answered.
I don't think I can place her. I don't go to the show much. She's darling, Santa said. So petite. You ever seen her in that cute picture where she played Tammy Irene?
Ain't that the picture where she went blind?
No, girl. You must be thinking of the wrong show.
Oh, I know who I was thinking of, Precious. I was thinking of June Wyman. She was sweet, too.
Oh, she was good, Santa said.
I remember that picture where she played the dummy who got herself raped.
Lord, I'm glad I didn't go see that show.
Oh, it was wonderful, babe. Very dramatic. You know, the look on that poor dummy's face when she got raped, I'll never forget it. Anybody want more coffee?
Mr. Robichaux asked.
Yeah, give me some there, Claude,
Santa said, folding the newspaper and throwing it on top of the refrigerator.
I'm sure sorry Angelo couldn't make it, that poor boy. He told me he's going to be working day and night on his own so he can bring somebody in. He's out someplace tonight, I guess.
You ought to heard what his Rita been telling me. It seems Angelo went out and bought a lot of expensive clothes he can wear, so maybe he can attract some character. Ain't that a shame? That just shows you how much that boy loves the force. If they was to kick him out, it'd break his heart. I sure hope he takes in some bum.
Angelo's got him a hard road to travel,
Mrs. Riley said absently. She was thinking of the Peace to Men of Goodwill sign that Ignatius had tacked to the front of their house after he had come home from work. Miss Annie had immediately started an inquisition about that as soon as it had appeared, screaming questions through her shutters.
What you think about somebody wants peace, Claude?
That sounds like a communist to me.
Mrs. Riley's worst fears were realized.
Who wants peace?
Santa asked.
Ignatius got a sign up in front of the house about peace.
I might have known, Santa said angrily. First that boy wants a king, now he wants peace. I'm telling you, Irene, for your own good, that boy's got to be put away.
He ain't wearing no earring. I ask him, and he says, I ain't wearing no earring, Mama.
Angelo don't lie.
Maybe he just got him a small one.
A earring's a earring to me. Ain't that right, Claude?
That's right,
Claude answered Santa.
Santa, honey, that's a sweet little blessed virgin you got on top of that TV,
Mrs. Riley said to get them off the earring topic. Everyone looked at the television set next to the refrigerator, and Santa said,
Ain't that nice, though? It's a little Our Lady of the television. It's got a suction cup base, so I don't knock it over when I'm banging around in the kitchen. I bought it by Lenny's. Lenny's got everything,
Mrs. Riley said.
It looks like it's made out of nice plastic, too. Don't break.
Well, how you kids like that dinner?
It was delicious,
Mr. Robichaux said.
It was wonderful, Mrs. Riley agreed. I ain't had me a good meal in a long time.
Ugh,
Santa belched.
I think I put too much garlic in them stuffed eggplants, but I got a heavy hand with garlic. Even my grandchildren tell me, they say, Hey, Mama, you sure got a heavy hand with garlic.
Ain't that sweet,
Mrs. Riley said of the gourmet grandchildren.
I thought the eggplants was fine,
Mr. Robichaux said.
I'm only happy when I'm scrubbing my floors and cooking my food,
Santa told her guests.
I love to fix a big pot of meatballs or jambalaya with shrimps.
I like to cook,
Mr. Robichaux said.
It helps out my daughter sometimes.
I bet it does,
Santa said.
A man who can cook is a big help around the house, believe me.
She kicked Mrs. Riley under the table.
A woman's got a man that likes to cook is a lucky girl.
You like to cook, Irene?
Mr. Robichaud asked.
You talking to me, Claude?
Mrs. Riley had been wondering what Ignatius looked like in an earring.
Come back out of the clouds, girl, Santa ordered. Claude here was asking you if you like to cook.
Yeah, Mrs. Riley lied. I like to cook okay, but sometimes it gets so hot in that kitchen, especially in the summer. You don't get no breeze out that alley.
Ignatius likes to eat junk anyways. You give Ignatius a few bottles of Dr. Nutt and plenty bakery cakes, and he's satisfied.
You ought to get you electric range, Mr. Robichaud said.
I bought my daughter one. It don't get hot like a gas stove.
Where are you getting all this money from, Claude?
Santa asked interestedly.
I got me a nice pension from the railroad. I was with them for 45 years, you know. They give me a beautiful gold pin when I retired.
Ain't that nice?
Mrs. Riley said.
You made good, huh, Claude?
Then, Mr. Robichaud said, I got me a few little rental properties around my house. I was always putting a little of my salary aside to invest in properties. Property's a good investment.
It sure is,
Santa said, rolling her eyes wildly at Mrs. Riley.
Now you well fixed, huh?
I'm pretty comfortable. But you know, sometimes I get tired of living with my daughter and her husband. I mean, they're young. They got their own family. They are very nice to me, but I'd rather have my own home. You know what I mean?
If I was you, Mrs. Riley said, I'd stay where I was. If your little daughter don't mind having you around, you got you a nice setup. I wished I had me a nice child. Be grateful for what you got, Claude.
Santa ground the heel of her shoe into Mrs. Riley's ankle.
Ouch!
Mrs. Riley cried.
Lord, I'm sorry, babe. Me and my big feet. Big feet's always been my problem. They can hardly fit me down by the shoe store. That clerk sees me coming and he says, Lord, here comes Miss Battaglia again. What I'm gonna do?
Your feet ain't so big,
Mrs. Riley observed, looking under the kitchen table.
I just got them squished up in this little pair of shoes. You ought to see them things when I'm barefoot, girl.
I got bum feet,
Mrs. Riley told the other two. Santa made a sign for Mrs. Riley not to discuss her deficiencies, but Mrs. Riley was not to be silenced.
Some days I can't hardly walk. I think they went bad when Ignatius was little and I used to have to carry him around. Lord, but he was slow walking, always falling down. He was sure heavy, too. Maybe that's how I got my arthritis.
Listen, you two,
Santa said quickly so that Mrs. Riley would not describe some new horrible deficiency.
Why don't we go see that cute little Debbie Reynolds?
That would be nice,
Mr. Robichaud said.
I never go to the show.
You want to see a show?
Mrs. Riley asked.
I don't know. My feet.
Oh, come on, girl. Let's get out the house. It smells like garlic in here.
I think Ignatius told me this movie ain't no good. He sees every picture that comes out, that boy.
Irene!
Santa said angrily.
You all the time thinking of that boy, and with all the trouble he's given you. You better wake up, babe. If you had any sense, you would have had that boy locked away at Charity Hospital a long time ago. They'd turn a hose on him. They'd stick electric socket in that boy. They'd show that Ignatius. They'd make him behave himself.
Yeah?
Mrs. Riley asked with interest.
How much that cost?
It's all for free, Irene. Socialized medicine,
Mr. Robichaud observed.
They probably got communists and fellow travelers working in that place.
They got nuns operating the place, Claude.
Lord, where are you all the time getting this communist stuff from?
Maybe them sisters been fooled,
Mr. Robichaud said.
Ain't that awful,
Mrs. Riley said sadly.
Them poor sisters, operating for a bunch of communists.
I don't care who's operating the place,
Santa said.
If it's free and they lock people away, Ignatius ought to be there.
Once Ignatius started talking to them people, they'd maybe get mad and lock him up for good,
Mrs. Riley said. But she was thinking that even that alternative wasn't too unattractive.
Maybe he wouldn't listen to the doctors.
They'd make him listen. They'd beat him in the head, they'd lock him up in a straitjacket, they'd pump some water on him,
Santa said a little too eagerly.
You gotta think about yourself, Irene, Mr. Robichaud said. That son of yours is gonna put you in your grave. That's it. You tell her, Claude.
Well, Mrs. Riley said, we'll give Ignatius a chance. Maybe he'll make good yet.
Selling weenies? Santa asked.
Lord.
She shook her head.
Well, let me go dump these dishes in the sink. Come on, let's go see that precious Debbie Reynolds.
A few minutes later, after Santa had stopped in the parlor to kiss her mother goodbye, the three of them set out for the theater. The day had been a balmy day. A south wind had been blowing steadily from the gulf. Now the evening was still warm. Heavy odors of Mediterranean cooking floated across the congested neighborhood from the open kitchen windows in every apartment building and double house. Each resident seemed to be making some contribution, however small, to the general cacophony of dropping pots, booming television sets, arguing voices, screaming children, and slamming doors.
St. Odo Parish is really at it tonight,
Santa commented thoughtfully, as the three slowly strolled down the narrow sidewalk between the curb and the steps of the double houses built in solid, straight rows down each block. The street lights shone on the treeless stretches of asphalt and cement and continuous old slate roofs.
It's even worse in the summertime. Everybody's out on the streets till 10, 11 o'clock.
Don't tell me, precious,
Mrs. Riley said as she hobbled dramatically between her friends.
Remember, I'm from Dauphin Street. We used to put the kitchen chairs out on the banquette and sit there till midnight sometimes, waiting for the house to cool off. And the things that people down here say, Lord!
Vicious is what it is, Santa agreed. Dirty mouths.
Poor Papa, Mrs. Riley said. He was so poor. Then when he went and got his hand caught in that fan belt, the people in the neighborhood had the nerve to say he must have been drunk. The anonymous letters we got about that. And my poor old Tante Boo-Boo, 80 years old. She was burning a candle for her poor departed husband, and it fall off the night table and sets a mattress on fire. The people said she was smoking in bed.
I believe people innocent until they're proven guilty.
That's the same way I feel, Claude,
Mrs. Riley said.
Just the other day I says to Ignatius, Ignatius, I think people innocent until they prove guilty.
Irene!
They crossed St. Claude Avenue during a lull in the heavy traffic and walked along the other side of the avenue under the neon lights. As they were passing a funeral parlor, Santa stopped to talk to one of the mourners standing out on the sidewalk.
Say, mister, who'd they got laid out in there?
She asked the man.
They waken old Lady Lopez,
the man answered.
You don't say. She the wife of that Lopez ran the little market over on Frenchman Street?
That's the one.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Santa said. What she died from?
Heart trouble.
Ain't that a shame?
Mrs. Riley said emotionally.
Poor girl.
Well, if I was dressed, Santa told the man, I'd go in and pay my respects. Me and my friends here are just on our way to a picture show. Thank you.
As they walked along, Santa described to Mrs. Riley the many sadnesses and tribulations that had comprised old Lady Lopez's dismal existence. Finally, Santa said,
I think I'll send her family a mass.
Lord,
Mrs. Riley said, overcome by old Lady Lopez's biography.
I think I'll send a mass, too, for the repose of that poor woman's soul.
Irene! Santa screamed. You don't even know them people!
Well, that's true,
Mrs. Riley agreed weakly. When they arrived at the theater, there was some discussion between Santa and Mr. Robichaud over who was going to buy the tickets. Mrs. Riley said that she would if she didn't have to meet a payment on Ignatius's trumpet before the week was out. Mr. Robichaud was adamant, though, and Santa at last let him have his way.
After all, Santa said to him as he handed tickets to the two ladies, you're the ones got all the money.
She winked at Mrs. Riley, whose mind had wandered again to that sign that Ignatius refused to explain to her. During most of the movie, Mrs. Riley thought about Ignatius's rapidly decreasing salary, the payment on the trumpet, the payment on the wrecked building, the earring, and the sign. Only Santa's happy exclamations of,
"Ain't she precious?" and, "Just take a look at that cute dress she's got, Irene,"
brought Mrs. Riley back to what was happening on the screen. Then something else drew her from her meditations about her son and her problems, both of which were really the same thing. Mr. Robichaud's hand had gently covered and was now holding hers. Mrs. Riley was too afraid to move. Why did movies always seem to make the men she had known, Mr. Riley and Mr. Robichaud, amorous? She stared blindly at the screen, on which she saw not Debbie Reynolds cavorting in color, but rather Jean Harlow taking a bath in black and white. Mrs. Riley was wondering if she could easily wrench her hand out of Mr. Robichaud's and bolt from the theater when Santa cried,
"Just watch it, Irene! I bet you little Debbie's gonna have her a baby!"
"A what?"
Mrs. Riley screamed wildly, bursting into crazy, loud tears that didn't subside until the frightened Mr. Robichaud took her maroon head and placed it carefully on his shoulder.
"Dear Rita, nature has sometimes made a fool, but a coxcomb is always of man's own making. Addison. As I was wearing the soles of my desert boots down to a mere sliver of crepe rubber on the old flagstone banquettes of the French Quarter in my fevered attempt to wrest a living from an unthinking and uncaring society, I was hailed by a cherished old acquaintance, Deviant. After a few minutes of conversation in which I established most easily my moral superiority over this degenerate, I found myself pondering once more the crises of our times. My mentality, uncontrollable and wanton as always, whispered to me a scheme so magnificent and daring that I shrank from the very thought of what I was hearing. "Stop!" I cried imploringly to my godlike mind. "This is madness!" But still I listened to the counsel of my brain. It was offering me the opportunity to save the world through degeneracy. There, on the worn stones of the quarter, I enlisted the aid of this wilted flower of a human in gathering his associates in foppery together behind a banner of brotherhood. Our first step will be to elect one of their number to some very high office, the presidency, if Fortuna spends us kindly. Then they will infiltrate the military. As soldiers, they will all be so continually busy in fraternizing with one another, tailoring their uniforms to fit like sausage skins, inventing new and varied battle dress, giving cocktail parties, etc., that they will never have time for battle. The one whom we finally make chief of staff will want only to attend to his fashionable wardrobe, a wardrobe which, alternately, will permit him to be either chief of staff or debutante, as the desire strikes him. In seeing the success of their unified fellows here, perverts around the world will also band together to capture the military in their respective countries. In those reactionary countries in which the deviants seem to be having some trouble in gaining control, we will send aid to them as rebels to help them in toppling their governments. When we have at last overthrown all existing governments, the world will enjoy not war, but global orgies conducted with the utmost protocol and the most truly international spirit. For these people do transcend simple national differences. Their minds are on one goal. They are truly united. They think as one. None of the pederasts in power, of course, will be practical enough to know about such devices as bombs. These nuclear weapons would lie rotting in their vault somewhere. From time to time, the chief of staff, the president, and so on, dressed in sequins and feathers, will entertain the leaders, i.e. the perverts, of all the other countries at balls and parties. Quarrels of any sort could easily be straightened out in the men's room of the redecorated United Nations. Ballets and Broadway musicals and entertainments of that sort will flourish everywhere, and will probably make the common folk happier than did the grim, hostile, fascistic pronouncements of their former leaders. Almost everyone else has had an opportunity to run the world. I cannot see why these people should not be given their chance. They have certainly been the underdog long enough. Their movement into power will be, in a sense, only a part of the global movement toward opportunity, justice, and equality for all. For example, can you name one good practicing transvestite in the Senate? No! These people have been without representation long enough. Their plight is a national, a global disgrace. Degeneracy, rather than signaling the downfall of a society, as it once did, will now signal peace for a troubled world, We must have new solutions to new problems. I shall act as a sort of mentor and guide for the movement. My not inconsiderable knowledge of world history, economics, religion, and political strategy acting as a reservoir, as it were, from which these people can draw rules of operational procedure. Boethius himself played a somewhat similar role in the degenerate Rome. As Chesterton has said of Boethius, "Thus he truly served as a guide, philosopher, and friend to many Christians, precisely because while his own times were corrupt, his own culture was complete." This time I shall really confound Myrna Minx. The scheme is too breathtaking for the literal liberal Minx mind, mired in a claustrophobic clutch of clichés. The crusade for Moorish dignity, my brilliant first attack upon the problems of our times, would have been a rather grand and decisive coup had it not been for the basically bourgeois world view of the rather simple people who were members of the vanguard. This time, however, I shall be working with people who eschew the insipid philosophy of the middle class, people who are willing to assume controversial positions, to follow their cause, however unpopular it may be, however it may threaten the smugness of the middle class. Does M. Minkoff want sex in politics? I shall give her sex in politics, and plenty of it. No doubt she will be too overcome to respond to the originality of my project. At the very least, she will seethe with envy. That girl must be attended to. Such effrontery cannot go unchecked. A debate between pragmatism and morality rages in my brain. Is the glorious end, peace, worth the awesome means, degeneracy? Like two figures in a medieval morality play, pragmatism and morality spar in the boxing ring of my brain. I cannot await the outcome of their furious debate. I am too obsessed with peace. If any perceptive film producers are interested in buying the movie rights to this journal, I might here make a note on the filming of this debate. A musical saw would provide excellent background accompaniment, and the hero's eyeball may be superimposed upon the debate scene in a most symbolic manner. Certainly some attractive new discovery could be found in a drugstore or a motel or in whatever den people are discovered to play the working boy. The film may be made in Spain, Italy, or some other interesting land which the cast may wish to see, such as North America. Sorry, those of you who are interested in the latest bleak Frankfurter news will find none. My mind is too preoccupied with the magnificence of this design. Now I must communicate with M. Minkoff and make some jottings for my lecture at the kickoff rally. Social note. My truant mother is gone again, which is really rather fortunate. Her vigorous assaults and blistering attacks against my being are negatively affecting my valve. She said that she was going out to attend the crowning of the May Queen at some church, but since it isn't May, I tend to doubt her veracity. The sophisticated comedy featuring my number one female film favorite is opening at a downtown palace momentarily. Somehow I must be there on opening day. I can only imagine the film's latest horrors, its flaunting of vulgarity in the face of theology and geometry, taste and decency. I do not understand this compulsion of mine for seeing movies. It almost seems as if movies are in my blood. Health note. My stomach is getting out of bounds. The seams of my vendor's smock are creaking ominously. Until later, Tab, your pacifist working boy. Mrs. Levy helped the renovated Miss Trixie up the steps and opened the door.
This is Levy Pants,
Miss Trixie snarled.
You're back again where you're wanted and needed, darling.
Mrs. Levy spoke as if she were comforting a child.
And how you've been missed. Every day Mr. Gonzalez has been on the phone begging for you. Isn't it wonderful to know that you're so vital to a business?
I thought I was retired.
The massive teeth snapped like a bear trap.
You people have tricked me.
Now are you happy?
Mr. Levy asked his wife. He was walking behind them, carrying one of Miss Trixie's bags of scraps.
If she had a knife on her, I'd be taking you to the hospital right now.
Listen to the fire in her voice, Mrs. Levy said. So vigorous. It's unbelievable.
Miss Trixie tried to break away from Mrs. Levy as they entered the office, but her pumps did not give her the traction that she was used to with sneakers, and she only wobbled.
She's back,
Mr. Gonzalez cried heartbrokenly.
"Can you believe your eyes?"
Mrs. Levy asked him. Mr. Gonzalez was forced to look at Miss Trixie, whose eyes were weak pools edged with blue shadow. Her lips had been extended in an orange line that almost reached her nostrils. Near the earrings, a few gray wisps of hair escaped from beneath the black wig, which was slightly awry. The short skirt revealed withered, bowed legs and small feet that made the pumps look like snowshoes. Whole days of napping under a sun lamp had baked Miss Trixie to a golden brown.
"She certainly looks fit," Mr. Gonzalez said.
His voice was false, and he smiled a broken smile.
"You've done her a wonderful service, Mrs. Levy."
"I am a very attractive woman,"
Miss Trixie babbled. Mr. Gonzalez laughed nervously.
"Now listen here," Mrs. Levy said to him. "Part of this woman's trouble is that kind of attitude. Ridicule she doesn't need."
Mr. Gonzalez tried unsuccessfully to kiss Mrs. Levy's hand.
"I want you to make her feel wanted, Gonzalez. This woman still has a sharp mind. Give her work that will exercise those faculties of hers. Give her more authority. She desperately needs an active role in this business."
"Definitely,"
Mr. Gonzalez agreed.
"I've said that myself all along. Haven't I, Miss Trixie?"
"Who?"
Miss Trixie snarled.
"I've always wanted you to assume more responsibility and authority,"
the office manager screamed.
"Isn't that correct?"
"Oh, shut up, Gomez."
Miss Trixie's teeth clattered like castanets.
"Have you bought me that Easter ham yet? Answer me that."
"All right, you've had your fun. Let's go,"
Mr. Levy said to his wife.
"Come on, I'm getting depressed."
"Just a moment," Mr. Gonzalez said. "I have some mail for you."
As the office manager went to his desk to get the mail, there was a crash in the rear of the office. Everyone, aside from Miss Trixie, who had begun napping on her desk, turned around and looked in the filing department. There, an extremely tall man with long black hair was picking up a file drawer that had fallen to the floor. He stuffed the filing roughly back into the drawer and slammed the drawer into its slot in the files.
"That's Mr. Zalatimo,"
Mr. Gonzalez whispered.
"He's only been with us for a few days, and I don't think he's going to work out. I don't think we'll want to include him in the Levy Pants plan."
Mr. Zalatimo looked confusedly at the filing cabinets and scratched himself. Then he opened another drawer and fumbled through its contents with one hand, while the other scratched at his armpit through his threadbare knitted shirt.
"Would you care to meet him?"
the office manager asked.
"No thanks," Mr. Levy said. "Where do you find the people that work in this place, Gonzalez? I never see people like this anywhere else."
"He looks like a gangster to me,"
Mrs. Levy said.
"You don't keep any cash around here, do you?"
"I think Mr. Zalatimo's honest,"
the office manager whispered.
"He only has trouble alphabetizing."
He handed Mr. Levy a sheaf of mail.
"These are mostly confirmations on your hotel reservations for spring practice. There's a letter in there from Abelman. It's addressed to you and not the company, and it's marked personal, so I thought you'd better open it. It's been around for a few days."
"What does that crack want now?"
Mr. Levy said angrily.
"Maybe he wonders what happened to a brilliant growing concern," Mrs. Levy observed. "Maybe he wonders what happened since Leon Levy died. Maybe this Abelman has some words of advice to a playboy. Read it, Gus. It will be your work for Levy Pants for the week."
Mr. Levy looked at the envelope, on which personal had been written three times in red ballpoint. He opened it and found a letter on which some attachment had been stapled.
"Dear Gus Levy, we were shocked and grievously injured to receive the attached letter. We have been a faithful merchant for your merchandise for 30 years and have heretofore always had the warmest affectionate feelings for your firm. Maybe you remember the wreath we sent when your father died, for which we spared no expense. This will be very short. After many nights without sleep, we have given the original letter to our lawyer, who is instigating a libel suit for $500,000. This may do a little to compensate for our hurt feelings. Get a lawyer. We will see you in court like gentlemen. No more threats, please. Very best wishes. I, Abelman, Manager, Abelman's Dry Goods."
Mr. Levy turned cold as he flipped the page and read the thermofaxed copy of the letter to Abelman's. It was incredible. Who would go to the trouble of writing things like that? Mr. I. Abelman, Mongoloid Esquire, your total lack of contact with reality, your blighted worldview, you may feel the sting of the lash across your pitiful shoulders. Worst of all, the Gus Levy signature looked fairly authentic. Abelman must be kissing the original right now and smacking his lips. To somebody like Abelman, that letter was like a savings bond, a blank draft on a bank.
"Who wrote this?"
Mr. Levy demanded, giving the letter to Mr. Gonzalez. "What is it, Gus? A problem? Are you having a problem? That's one of your problems. You never tell me your problems."
"Oh, my goodness!"
Mr. Gonzalez squeaked.
"This is horrible!"
"Silence!"
Miss Trixie snapped. "What is it, Gus? Something you didn't handle correctly? Some authority you delegated to somebody else?"
"Yes, it's a problem. It's a problem that means we could lose the shirts off our backs."
"What?" Mrs. Levy grabbed the letters from Mr. Gonzalez. She read them and became a hag. Her lacquered curls turned into snakes. "Now you've done it. Anything to get back at your father, to ruin his business. I knew it was going to end like this."
"Oh, shut up. I never write the letters around here."
"Susan and Sandra will have to quit college. They'll be selling themselves to sailors and gangsters like that one there."
"Huh?"
Mr. Zalatimo asked, sensing that he was being discussed.
"You're sick!"
Mrs. Levy shouted at her husband.
"Quiet!"
"And will I be any better off?"
Mrs. Levy's aquamarine lids were trembling.
"What will become of me? Already my life has been wrecked. What happens to me now? Prowling in garbage cans, following the fleet? My mother was right."
"Quiet!"
Miss Trixie demanded, this time much more fiercely.
"You people are the noisiest I've ever met."
Mrs. Levy had collapsed in a chair, sobbing something about going out to sell Avon products.
"What do you know about this, Gonzalez?"
Mr. Levy asked the office manager, whose lips had turned white.
"I don't know a thing," Mr. Gonzalez piped. "It's the first time I've seen that letter."
"Do you write the correspondence around here?"
"I didn't write that."
His lips were quivering.
"I wouldn't do something like that to Levy Pants."
"No, I know you wouldn't."
Mr. Levy tried to think.
"Somebody really had it in for us."
Mr. Levy went over to the files, pushed the scratching Mr. Zalatimo aside, and opened the files in the A's. There was no Abelman folder. The drawer was completely empty. He opened several other drawers, but half of them were empty, too. What a way to begin fighting a libel suit.
"What do you people do with the filing?"
"I was wondering about that myself,"
Mr. Zalatimo said vaguely.
"Gonzalez, what was the name of that big kook you had working in here? The big fat one with the green cap?"
"Mr. Ignatius Riley. He handled the letter to go out."
Who had composed that awful thing?
"Hey!"
Jones's voice said over the telephone.
"You people still got a fat mother with a green cap working there at Levy Pan? A big white guy got him a mustache?"
"No, we don't,"
Mr. Gonzalez answered in a shrill voice and slammed the phone down.
"Who was that?"
Mr. Levy asked.
"Oh, I don't know. Someone from Mr. Riley."
The office manager wiped his forehead with a handkerchief.
"The one who tried to make the factory workers kill me."
"Riley?"
Miss Trixie said.
"That wasn't Riley, that was..."
"The young idealist?"
Mrs. Levy sobbed.
"Who wanted him?"
"I don't know," the office manager answered. "It sounded like a Negro voice to me."
"Well, I guess so," Mrs. Levy said. "He's out trying to help some other unfortunates right now. It's encouraging to know that his idealism is still intact."
Mr. Levy had been thinking of something, and he asked the office manager,
"What was the name of that kook?"
"Riley. Ignatius J. Riley."
"It was?"
Miss Trixie said with interest.
"That's strange. I always thought it..."
"Miss Trixie, please,"
Mr. Levy said angrily. That Riley blimp was working for the company at the time that that letter to Abelman was dated.
"Do you think that Riley would write a letter like that?"
"Maybe,"
Mr. Gonzalez said.
"I don't know.
I had high hopes for him until he tried to get that worker to brain me.
That's right, Mrs. Levy moaned. Try to pin it on the young idealist. Put him away where his idealism won't bother you. People like the young idealist don't deal in underhanded things like that. Wait until Susan and Sandra hear about this.
Mrs. Levy made a gesture that indicated that the girls would clearly go into a state of shock.
Negroes are calling here to get his counsel. You're about to frame him. I can't take much more of this, Gus. I can't, I can't.
Then do you want me to say I wrote that?
Of course not,
Mrs. Levy screamed at her husband.
I'm supposed to end in the poorhouse? If the young idealist wrote it, he goes to jail for forgery.
Say, what's going on?
Mr. Zolotimo asked.
Is this dump gonna close down or what? I mean, I'd like to know.
Shut up, gangster,
Mrs. Levy answered wildly.
Before we pin it on you.
Huh?
Will you keep quiet? You're getting everything confused,
Mr. Levy said to his wife. Then he turned to the office manager.
Get me this Riley's phone number.
Mr. Gonzalez awakened Miss Trixie and asked her for a phone book.
I keep all of the phone books, Miss Trixie snapped. And no one is going to use them.
Then look up a Riley on Constantinople Street for us.
Well, all right, Gomez,
Miss Trixie snarled.
Hold your horses.
She took the three hoarded office telephone books out of some recess in her desk, and studying the pages with a magnifying glass, gave them a number. Mr. Levy dialed it, and a voice answered,
Good morning, Regal Cleaners.
Give me one of those phone books,
Mr. Levy hollered.
No,
Miss Trixie rasped, slapping her hand down on the stack of books, guarding them with her newly enameled nails.
You'll only lose it. I'll find the right number. I must say you people are very impatient and excitable. Staying at your house took 10 years off my life. Why can't you let poor Riley alone? You already kicked him out over nothing.
Mr. Levy dialed the second number that she gave him. A woman who sounded slightly intoxicated answered and told him that Mr. Riley wouldn't be home until late in the afternoon. Then she started crying, and Mr. Levy got depressed and thanked her and hung up.
Well, he's not at home,
Mr. Levy told the audience in the office.
Mr. Riley always seemed to have the best interests of Levy Pants at heart, the office manager said sadly. Why he started that riot, I'll never know.
For one thing, because he had a police record.
When he came to apply, I certainly didn't think he was a police character.
The office manager shook his head.
He seemed so refined.
Mr. Gonzalez watched Mr. Zolotimo probing his long index finger high into one of his nostrils. What would this one do? His feet tingled with fear. The factory door banged open, and one of the workers screamed,
Hey, Mr. Gonzalez! Mr. Palermo just burned his hand on one of them furnace door!
There were sounds of disorder in the factory. A man was cursing.
Oh, my goodness! Mr. Gonzalez cried. Quiet the workers! I'll be there in a minute!
Come on, Mr. Levy said to his wife. Let's get out of here. I'm getting heartburn.
Just a moment.
Mrs. Levy gestured to Mr. Gonzalez.
About Miss Trixie, I want you to give her a welcome every morning. Give her meaningful work to do. In the past, her insecurity probably made her afraid of taking any responsible work. I think she's over that now. Basically, she has a deep-seated hatred of Levy Pants that I've analyzed as being rooted in fear. The insecurity and fear have led to hatred.
Of course,
the office manager said, half-listening. The factory sounded bad.
Go see about the factory, Gonzalez, Mr. Levy said. I'll get in touch with Riley.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Gonzalez made a deep bow to them and dashed out of the office.
Okay.
Mr. Levy was holding the door open. Just come near, Levy Pants, and you were subjected to all sorts of annoyances and depressing influences. You couldn't leave the place alone for a minute. Anyone who wanted to take it easy and not be bothered had better not have a company like Levy Pants. Gonzalez didn't even know what kind of mail was going out of the office.
Come on, Dr. Freud, let's go.
Look how calm you are. It doesn't matter to you that Abelman is about to sue our lives away if he can.
The aquamarine lids trembled.
Aren't you going to get the idealist?
Some other time. I've had enough for one day.
Meanwhile, Abelman has Scotland Yard at our throats.
He's not even home.
Mr. Levy didn't feel like speaking with the crying woman again.
I'll call him tonight from the coast. There's nothing to worry about. They can't sue me for a $500,000 for a letter I didn't write.
Oh, no. I'm sure somebody like Abelman could. I can just see that lawyer he's got. Crippled from chasing ambulances. Mutilated from being caught in fires he started for insurance money.
Well, you'll take the bus back to the coast if you don't hurry up. I'm getting indigestion from this office.
All right, all right. You can't spare a minute of your wasted life for this woman, can you?
Mrs. Levy indicated the loudly snoring Miss Trixie. She shook Miss Trixie's shoulder.
I'm going, darling. Everything is going to be fine. I've spoken to Mr. Gonzalez, and he's delighted to see you again.
Quiet!
Miss Trixie ordered. Her teeth snapped menacingly.
Come on, before I have to take you to get a rabies shot,
Mr. Levy said angrily and grabbed his wife through her fur coat.
Just look at this place.
A gloved hand gestured to the dingy office furniture, to the warped floors, to the crepe paper streamers still hanging from the days when I.J. Riley was custodian of the files, to Mr. Zalatimo, who was kicking at the wastebasket in alphabetical frustration.
Sad, sad. A business down the drain, unhappy young idealist stooping to forgery to get even.
Get out of here, you people!
Miss Trixie snarled, slapping her palm on the desk.
Listen to the conviction in that voice,
Mrs. Levy said proudly as her round, furry figure was being hauled through the door.
I've worked a miracle.
The door closed and Mr. Zalatimo came over to Miss Trixie, absently scratching himself. He tapped her on the shoulder and asked,
Say, lady, maybe you can help me out with this. What would you say comes first, Willis or Williams?
Miss Trixie glared at him for a moment. Then she sank her teeth into his hand. In the factory, Mr. Gonzalez heard Mr. Zalatimo screaming. He didn't know whether to desert the seared Mr. Palermo and see what had happened, or stay in the factory, where the workers had begun dancing with one another under the loudspeakers. Levy Pants demanded a lot of a person. In the sports car, as they drove through the salt marshes that led back to the coast, Mrs. Levy, pulling her blowing fur up closer around her neck, said,
I'm establishing a foundation.
I see. Suppose Abelman's lawyer gets the money out of us.
He won't. The young idealist is trapped, she said calmly. A police record inciting a riot? His character references will stink.
Oh. Suddenly you agree that your young idealist is a criminal.
He obviously was all alone.
But you wanted to get your hands on Miss Trixie.
That's right.
Well, there will be no foundation.
Susan and Sandra will hate to know that your bum's attitude toward the world almost ruined them, that because you won't even take the time to supervise your own company, we have somebody suing us for $500,000. The girls will really resent that. The least that you've always given them has been material comfort. Susan and Sandra will hate to know that they could have ended up as prostitutes or worse.
They might at least have made some money at it. As it is, they're all for free.
Please, Gus, not another word. Even my brutalized spirit has some sensitivity left. I can't let you slander my girls like that.
Mrs. Levy sighed contentedly.
This Abelman business is the most dangerous of all your mistakes and errors and evasions through the years. The girls' hair will curl when they read of it. Of course, I won't frighten them if you don't want me to.
How much do you want for this foundation?
I haven't decided yet. I've been composing the rules and regulations.
May I ask what this foundation is going to be called, Mrs. Guggenheim? The Susan and Sandra Slush Fund?
It will be called the Leon Levy Foundation, in honor of your father. I have to do something to honor your father's name for all that you haven't done to honor it. The awards will commemorate the memory of that great man.
I see. In other words, you'll be tossing laurels at old men outstanding only for their unequaled meanness.
Please, Gus!
Mrs. Levy held up a gloved hand. The girls have been thrilled by my reports on the Miss Trixie project. The Foundation will really give them faith in their name. I must do all I can to make up for your complete failure as a parent.
Getting an award from the Leon Levy Foundation will be a public insult. Your hands will be really full of libel suits then. Libel suits from the recipients. Forget it. Whatever happened to bridge? Other people are still playing it. Can't you go play golf at Lakewood anymore? Take some more dancing lessons. Take Miss Trixie with you.
To be quite honest with you, Miss Trixie was beginning to bore me the last few days.
So that's why the rejuvenation course ended all of a sudden.
I've done all I can for that woman. Susan and Sandra are proud that I've tried to keep her active so long.
Well, there will be no Leon Levy Foundation.
Do you resent it? There's resentment in your voice. I can hear it. There's hostility. Gus, for your own sake, that doctor in the medical arts building, Lenny's savior, before it's too late. Now I'll have to watch over you every minute to see to it that you get in touch with that idealist criminal as soon as possible. I know you. You'll put it off, and Abelman will have a van out in front of Levy's Lodge taking everything away.
Including your exercising board.
I've already told you, Mrs. Levy screamed. Leave the board out of this! She adjusted her ruffled furs. Now get to that Riley psycho before Abelman comes down here and starts taking the hubcaps off this sports car. With somebody like that, Abelman has no case. Lenny's doctor can analyze Riley, and the state will put him away someplace where he can't try to wreck people. Thank goodness Susan and Sandra won't know that they almost ended up selling roach tablets from door to door. Their hearts would break if they knew how carelessly their own father handled their welfare.
George had set up his stakeout on Poydras Street, across from the Paradise Vendors Incorporated garage. He had remembered the name on the wagon and looked up the address of the vending firm. All morning he had waited for the big vendor, who had never shown up. Perhaps he had been fired for stabbing the ferry in Pirate's Alley. At noon, George had left his outpost and gone down to the quarter to get the packages from Miss Lee. Now he was back on Poydras, wondering whether the vendor was going to show. George had decided to try to be nice to him, to hand him a few dollars right away. Hot dog vendors must be poor. He'd appreciate a few bucks. This vendor was a perfect front man. He would never know what was coming off. He had a good education, though. At last, sometime after 1 o'clock, a white smock billowed off the trolley and whipped into the garage. A few minutes later, the oddball vendor wheeled his wagon out onto the sidewalk. He was still wearing the earring, scarf, and cutlass, George noticed. If he put them on in the garage, they must be part of his sales gimmick. You could tell by the way that he talked, though, that he had gone to school a long time. That was probably what was wrong with him. George had been wise enough to get out of school as soon as possible. He didn't want to end up like that guy. George watched him push the wagon a few feet down the block, stop, and tape a piece of tablet paper to the front of his wagon. George would use psychology on him. He'd play up to the vendor's education. That and the money should make him rent out his bun compartment. Then an old man stuck his head out of the garage, ran up behind the vendor, and struck him across the back with a long fork.
"Get moving, you ape!"
the old man shouted.
"You're already late. It's already afternoon. Today you're gonna bring in a profit or else."
The vendor said something coolly and quietly. George couldn't understand it, but it lasted a long time.
"I don't care if your mother takes dope,"
the old man answered.
I don't want to hear no more bullshit about that automobile accident and your dreams and your goddamn girlfriend. Now get out of here, you big baboon. I want $5 minimum from you today.
With a push from the old man, the vendor rolled to the corner and disappeared onto St. Charles. After the old man returned to the garage, George slouched off in pursuit of the wagon. Unaware that he was being trailed, Ignatius pushed his cart against the traffic down St. Charles toward the quarter. He had stayed up so late the night before, working on his lecture for the kickoff rally, that he hadn't been able to move from his yellowed sheets until almost noon. And then it had only been his mother's violent pounding and screaming that had awakened him.
Now that he was out on the streets, he had a problem. Today, the sophisticated comedy was opening at the RKO Orpheum. He had been able to bleed 10 cents out of his mother for carfare home, although she had even begrudged him that. Somehow, he had to sell 5 or 6 hot dogs quickly, park the wagon somewhere, and get to that theater so that his disbelieving eyes could drink in every blasphemous technicolored moment. Lost in speculation about means for raising the money, Ignatius did not notice that for quite some time his cart had been traveling in a straight and unswerving line. When he attempted to pull closer to the curb, the cart would not incline to the right at all. Stopping, he saw that one of the bicycle tires had lodged in the groove of a streetcar track. He tried to bump the cart out of the groove. It was too heavy to be easily bounced. He bent and tried to lift the cart on one side. As he slipped his hands beneath the big tin bun, he heard through the light mist the grinding of an approaching streetcar. The hard little bumps appeared on his hands, and his valve, after wavering for a moment of frantic decision, slammed closed. Wildly, Ignatius pulled upward on the tin bun. The bicycle tire shot up out of the tracks, rose upward, balanced for a second in the air, and then became horizontal as the cart turned over loudly on its other side. One of the little lids in the tin bun opened and deposited a few steaming hot dogs on the street.
"Oh, my God!"
Ignatius mumbled to himself, watching the silhouette of the streetcar forming a half block away.
"What vicious trick is Fortuna playing on me now?"
Deserting the wreck, Ignatius lumbered down the tracks toward the streetcar, the white moo-moo of a uniform swishing around his ankles. The olive and copper trolley car ground slowly toward him, leisurely pitching and rocking. The motorman, seeing the huge, spherical, white figure panting in the center of the tracks, slid the car to a halt and opened one of the front windows.
"Pardon me, sir,"
the earring called up to him.
"If you will wait a moment, I shall attempt to ride my listing craft."
George saw his opportunity. He ran over to Ignatius and said cheerily,
"Come on, Prof, let's you and me get this off the street."
"Oh, my God!" Ignatius thundered. "My pubescent nemesis! What a promising day this appears to be. I'm apparently to be run over by a streetcar and robbed simultaneously, thereby setting a paradise record. Get away, you depraved urchin."
"You grab that end and I'll get this one."
The streetcar clanged at them.
"Oh, all right," Ignatius said finally. "Actually, I would be perfectly happy to let this ridiculous liability lie here on its side."
George took one end of the bun and said,
"You better close that little door before more of them weenies falls out."
Ignatius kicked the little door closed, as if he were playing to win in a professional football game, neatly severing a protruding hot dog into 2 6-inch sections.
"Take it easy, Prof. You're gonna break your wagon."
"Shut up, you truant. I didn't ask you to make conversation."
"Okay," George said, shrugging. "I mean, I'm just trying to help you out."
"How could you possibly help me?"
Ignatius bellowed, baring a tan fang or two.
"Some authority of society is probably hot on the scent of your suffocating hair tonic right now. Where did you come from? Why are you following me?"
"Look, you want me to help you pick up this pile of junk?"
"Pile of junk? Are you talking about this paradise vehicle?"
The streetcar clanged at them again.
"Come on," George said. "Up."
"I hope you realize," Ignatius said as he breathlessly lifted the wagon, "that our association is only the result of an emergency."
The cart bounced back onto its 2 bicycle tires, the contents of the tin bun rattling against its sides.
"Okay, Prof, there you go. Glad I could help you out."
"In case you haven't noticed, you waif, you are about to be hooked on the cow catcher of that streetcar."
The streetcar rolled by them slowly so that the conductor and motorman could study Ignatius's costume more closely. George grabbed one of Ignatius's paws and stuck $2 in it.
"Money?"
Ignatius asked happily.
"Thank God."
He quickly pocketed the 2 bills.
"I'd rather not ask the obscene motive for this, I'd like to think that you're attempting to make amends in your simple way for slandering me on my dismal first day with this ludicrous wagon.
That's it, Prof. You said it better than I ever could. You're a really educated guy.
Oh?
Ignatius was very pleased.
There may be some hope for you yet. Hot dog?
No, thanks.
Then pardon me while I have one. My system is petitioning for appeasement.
Ignatius looked down into the well of his wagon.
My God, the hot dogs are quite disordered.
While Ignatius was slamming doors and plunging his paws down into the well, George said,
Now I helped you out, Prof. Maybe you can do the same for me.
Perhaps,
Ignatius said disinterestedly, biting into the hot dog.
You see these?
George indicated the brown paper packages he was carrying under his arms.
These are school supplies. Now, this is my problem. I gotta pick them up from the distributor at lunchtime, but I can't deliver them to the schools until after school's closed. So I gotta carry them around for almost 2 hours. You understand? What I'm looking for is a place to put these things in the afternoon. Now, I could meet you someplace about 1 and put them in your bun compartment and come get them out sometime before 3.
How bogus, Ignatius belched. Do you seriously expect me to believe you? Delivering school supplies after the schools are closed?
I'll pay you a couple of bucks every day.
You will?
Ignatius asked with interest.
Well, you will have to pay me a week's rent in advance. I don't deal in small sums.
George opened his wallet and gave Ignatius $8.
Here. With the 2 you already got, that makes 10 for the week.
Ignatius happily pocketed the new bills and ripped one of the packages from George's arms, saying,
I must see what it is that I'm storing. You're probably selling goofballs to infants.
Hey! George shouted. I can't deliver the stuff if it's opened.
Too bad for you.
Ignatius fended off the boy and tore off the brown wrapping. He saw a stack of what looked like postcards.
What are these? Visual aids for civics or some other equally stultifying high school subject?
Give me that, you nut!
Oh, my God!
Ignatius stared at what he saw. Once in high school, someone had shown him a pornographic photograph, and he had collapsed against a water cooler, injuring his ear. This photograph was far superior. A nude woman was sitting on the edge of a desk next to a globe of the world. The suggested onanism with a piece of chalk intrigued Ignatius. Her face was hidden behind a large book. While George evaded indifferent slaps from the unoccupied paw, Ignatius scrutinized the title on the cover of the book. Initius Manlius Severinus Boethius, The Consolation of Philosophy.
Do I believe what I'm seeing? What brilliance! What taste! Good grief!
Give that back!
George pleaded.
This one is mine,
Ignatius gloated, pocketing the top card. He handed the torn package back to George and looked at the piece of torn wrapping between his fingers. There was an address on it. He pocketed that, too.
Where in the world did you get these? Who is this brilliant woman?
None of your business.
I see. A secret operation.
Ignatius thought of the address on the piece of paper. He would do his own investigating. Some destitute woman intellectual was doing anything for a dollar. Her worldview must be quite incisive, if her reading material were any guide. It could be that she was in the same situation as the working boy, a seer and philosopher cast into a hostile century by forces beyond her control. Ignatius must meet her. She might have some new and valuable insights.
Well, in spite of my misgivings, I shall make my cart available to you. However, you must watch the cart this afternoon. I have a rather urgent appointment.
Hey, what is this? How long are you going to be?
About 2 hours.
I got to get uptown by 3 o'clock.
Well, you shall be a little late this afternoon,
Ignatius said angrily.
I am already lowering my standards by associating with you and fouling up my bun compartment. You should be glad that I haven't turned you in. I have on the police force a brilliant friend, a sly undercover agent, Patrolman Mancuso.
He is just looking for the sort of a break a case like yours would offer. Fall to your knees and be grateful for my benevolence.
Mancuso? Wasn't that the name of the undercover agent who had stopped him in the restroom?